On this week's 51%, a college student looks into why her region is known as the Goiter Belt and what's in the water. We hear about a Code Like a Girl event and meet an artist who talks about the reprise of her installation.
I'm trying to create a space that's about women's autonomy, sensuality, desire, and also power.
I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. One young woman in Southwest Virginia has become a super sleuth. With a head full of questions and a heart full of concern, one college student teamed up with her mentor to find out what was poisoning the water in her community. Lilia Fukin reports.
This is Madison Couch.
The Central Appalachian region of Virginia is the southwestern tip of Virginia, close to Kentucky and Tennessee.
Madison grew up in the mountains of southwestern Virginia and went to college there at the University of Virginia at Wise.
We're in mountains, beautiful mountains. We have a lot of streams. We have a lot of coal industry. It's a beautiful place to live.
But a few years ago, she began to notice something alarming in her community.
It's highly affected by thyroid disorders.
It's part of what's called the goiter belt.
A goiter is simply an enlarged thyroid. And they can be malignant. If they are, they can be treated easily. It's an easy cancer to treat.
It turned out Madison lived in a hot spot for thyroid disorders. And these aren't the kinds of disorders brought on by iodine insufficiency or genetic predisposal. Madison's mother, uncle, and grandmother all ended up with various thyroid disorders. So when her grandmother was diagnosed, Madison started asking questions.
I asked the pathologist why I had always grown up hearing of thyroid disorders in my area. Neighbors, friends of the family, and even family members have been diagnosed.
Her grandmother's pathologist did not have a clear answer for Madison. What she did say was that after she, the pathologist, moved to this region from Chicago, she developed a goiter too. And goiters don't run in her family either. So when Madison got back to school, she met with her mentor, Dr. Wally Smith, and started researching what could explain the high incidence of goiters.
It was documented that coal can degrade and release a chemical into the soil that has been tested to cause thyroid disorders. But no one had gone as far as to do the digging to see if the chemical was in our area.
So Madison and Dr. Smith decided to look for this chemical or compound they'd read about. Phenol.
So when coal degrades, it releases phenols, which leach into the soil, and they stay in the soil and also get into the water.
Madison and Smith tested 45 different streams in the region for phenols.
We did find significant amount of phenols in the National Forest area and the mountaintop removal area.
Here's the problem. The phenols from coal are in some of the drinking water.
For example, we got a sample of water from a straight pipe that was stuck into the side of a mountain.
This kind of straight piping is a direct tap into the spring water, done by literally sticking a pipe into it. The pipe comes straight out the side of the mountain, and you get what one would think is the cleanest, freshest water possible.
It is very clean, but it seeps through coal seams, so it picks up phenols on the way. So we did find high concentrations in that as well. The most important find of everything that we did was that people on private well systems were more likely to have a thyroid disorder.
Madison says that if you live outside the coal industry, you don't really have to worry about phenols being in your water supply. But it's a major problem in Central Appalachia.
I am absolutely not targeting coal companies. I personally love them, and it's a big industry in our area. It's just any time that coal is present, this is an issue. And this can also leach into the soil. It's just a matter of if coal is underneath the soil or not. So whether the ground is being disturbed or mined, you know, we would still have this problem.
So for now, what's Madison's solution?
I buy distilled or spring water, and my pets even drink spring or distilled water. My whole family and all of my pets do not get any tap water.
For the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, I'm Lilia Fukin.
We bring you a story that was recorded at a Code Like a Girl event at GE Digital in San Ramon, California. It is produced by Megan Jones and originally aired on Inflection Point with Lauren Schiller from KALW. The GE Women's Network put on a day-long STEM event for 60 middle school girls. The event had a Harry Potter theme, which delighted the girls as they learned they could conjure up magic with code. Parseltongue, anyone?
Sire. We are in the Design Center at GE Digital, and today we will be setting up for the Code Like a Girl, Take Your Daughters to Work Day. It's Harry Potter themed, which is definitely part of the reason that we are very excited about it. My name is Julia Gron. I'm in the Digital Technology Leadership Program here at GE. I just graduated from Barnard College with a degree in economics and computer science. You know, in the books, in potion making, you whip some things together and then you have this thing that creates a reaction in someone else or yourself. To me, that's like coding. You know, you study up, you realize what you need to put together, and then you create something that makes things move, and you don't really see what's happening behind the scenes, but you see it on the front end. And to me, that feels like magic.
Welcome. Just a quick moment to tell you about the day. This morning, history of magic and Muggle studies. Next, we're going to do divination. And
I didn't really expect that it would tie in so close, so I'm really happy about that. Because I'm like a diehard Harry Potter fan.
My name is Diana Freeman Baer, and I'm a user experience designer at GE with the Emerging Verticals team. You're looking at the Design Center Great Hall with hanging candles and Tom Lee, who is in a robe just like a professor at Hogwarts. And there are 60 girls sitting at three long tables with computers in front of them.
We're going to learn four important lessons today to defend against these evil villains online. And two, charms.
They're going to actually have to create an algorithm to decode the password for the Chamber of Secrets. And they're doing that in Parseltongue. First, they'll brainstorm what the algorithm will be, and then they'll actually take that and code it into Scratch. The only way to actually get it to work is that they have to push the code, so they actually have to make a release, which is real coding skills.
There was this Harry Potter dude. We had to like make a code so we can make him talk and stuff. So I didn't know I could do that, but I did it.
My name is Ashley Haynes-Gaspar. I am the Global Support Vice President and General Manager here at GE Digital. This is the second year that we are doing hashtag Code Like a Girl. And it's important for me to do this because in my job, I travel a ton. And my daughter always is asking where I'm going and why I have to leave. And what's really special about this event is that it lives at the intersection of two deep loves and passions for me. The first is what I do when I come to this building, and the second is what I do when I go home. And to be able to have that overlap of those two things is incredibly powerful and special, and frankly, a little emotional for me.
Well, I mean, the thing was, I didn't want to wake up this morning early, and then
it was worth
it. So because of that, I didn't really want to go. But then now I'm like,
it was worth it, like getting up, you know, that stuff.
Why is it important for you that I learn STEM stuff?
Because I do STEM and I enjoy it so much that I feel like you shouldn't be deprived of this fun that I'm having every day at work.
My daughter's already pretty inspired creatively. She draws a lot. She paints a lot. I think the outcome I would like to see is now her to take it to the next level and be inspired with STEM.
Why was it important for you, for me to come today?
So that you don't lose your interest in STEM. You have the way where you look closely at things. You think through all the possibilities, and that's something that's very helpful in STEM.
I had a little girl grab me on her way out this afternoon, and what she said was, the things that she tells herself are true is that she's good at art and that she's good at sports. And what she learned today about herself is that she's also good at making new friends and that she's good at trying new things and that she's good at figuring out ways to solve problems. And those are all wonderful things for all little girls to learn about themselves.
What surprised you?
Wait. Well, for one, that I actually know stuff, but
medals surprised me because I wasn't expecting them. Like, they're real medals. Like, this is the second medal I've ever gotten, like, in my entire life, and it's not a participation medal. So, pretty happy.
I think when the little girls showed up today, they were absolutely expecting to do some coding because that's what their parents do when they come to work. I think any good software engineer would tell you that it's not enough to code. What you have to have is the context, the empathy, and the why behind what you're doing, what you're doing.
Diana, why are you crying?
We need more people to do these things for girls. It's not just the girls, the volunteers too. They walk out of here invigorated to go back to their jobs. They find the passion that they had about the profession that they're in. They see these girls with so much life, and they go back to their jobs. They get to do the same thing.
This piece was recorded on-site at GE Digital in San Ramon, California. I'm the producer, Megan Jones. Jillian Robertson was my assistant producer. And if you want to find out more about what GE is doing in terms of STEM education for girls, you can go to ge-girls.com.
No.
Hello, world.
I can't believe we're going to be on radio.
Hello, world.
Wait, so is this like broadcasted live or something?
Yeah, we all did a really good job.
Yes!
Salaries for members of the military start at about $1,500 a month, and that can present financial challenges, especially for service members who are trying to raise families. There are signs that thousands of active duty military families are relying on federal programs or food pantries to help make ends meet, but it's difficult to know just how many are in need. Dorian Marina reports from San Diego.
It's a Wednesday morning at the Camp Pendleton Marine Base near San Diego, and families are lined up for the monthly food pantry. Kara Deflifson and her husband are both active duty Marines.
We most like to get the avocado, lemons, some vegetables to cook up. This probably saves us anywhere between $100 and $300 each time we come.
That means a lot, she says, especially as they prepare for a big change after her husband's 5 years of service.
My husband's actually transitioning out, and we have a four-month-old daughter. And so that extra money, it just helps us be more financially ready for that transition.
The pantry is run by a nearby church, just one of several that bring donated food on base for military families every month. Today, about 100 families fill bags with fresh fruit and vegetables, meat, canned beans, and baby items like diapers. For Sarai Vescarando, the pantry helps meet the needs of her two teenage kids and husband, an active duty Marine.
It helps. I will say that basically I don't have to buy canned stuff, and I don't have to buy milk or cereal as much as I would.
Food pantries like this one point to a real need in the military, says Abby Liebman of Mazan, an anti-hunger advocacy group based in Los Angeles.
There's nothing that makes you feel more vulnerable or undermines your ability to live your life than not knowing if you're going to be able to feed your family.
Her group tracks the help available to military families across the country.
On most, if not all, military bases in the United States, there is either a food pantry on the base or near that base. That to us is a pretty serious indicator that there's an awareness that there is a problem.
But it's hard to figure out just how big that problem is. The Department of Agriculture estimates about 2% of active duty military are enrolled in the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, which used to be known as food stamps. That works out to about 23,000 service members, a figure consistent with the Census Bureau's tally. But there are signs that could be missing a larger picture. For example, about a quarter of all children that go to Defense Department schools qualify for the free lunch program. And in a recent survey run by military spouses called Blue Star Families, 7% of active duty families said they faced food insecurity over the past year. That would be more than 80,000 families. Liebman says the most vulnerable tend to be newly enlisted, lower-paid service members with children.
It's about a system that was designed to support them that is failing in that goal. And we have a military that takes care of its own. Well, here's a place where it's failing, so it needs to course correct.
This issue has caught the attention of the Government Accountability Office. It called on the Pentagon last year to do a better job tracking how many service members need or use food assistance programs. 10 months later, the DoD has yet to announce reforms. Johnny Michael, a DoD spokesperson, says the Pentagon sees nutrition as a key part of military readiness. But this is still just a small slice of the military.
This would affect only our most junior personnel and those under specific circumstances in terms of the number of dependents and where they might be at.
Plus, he says, as service members get promoted, they earn more. That, along with other benefits like health care and housing, help to stabilize families and keep them self-sufficient.
So those things will continue to trend upward for the service members. Their pay will continue to increase. And hopefully they'll find themselves in that situation only a very short period of time.
But advocates say without clear data, some families could be falling through the cracks. In the meantime, food pantries like the one at Camp Pendleton continue, helping military families put food on the table. In San Diego, I'm Dorian Marina.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project. Next, we hear from New York-based artist Patricia Cronin as she talks about women, power, and sexuality inside her Tack Room installation at the 2017 Armory Show. Her reprise of the immersive environment she exhibited 20 years ago sparks the following conversation about feminist issues, politics, and the artist's resolve to represent untold stories about women.
I'm trying to create a space that's about women's autonomy, sensuality, desire, and also power. It was originally installed 20 years ago, so I'm really excited that Eric chose it for his platform section. And it was an Art Forum Top 10 Show of the Year, big New York Times review in that corner, and Sculpture Magazine over here. And I'm just waiting for Hermes to sponsor something with me.
I can notice there are a few Hermes bags around. But it's just so great because the work really questions how we place value on anything in the world, mm-hmm. whether it be real estate or horses or, of course, by extension, art.
This is Fresh Art International. I'm Kathy Bird. Today I'm taking you to New York City, to Pier 92 on the Hudson River in Manhattan. That's where I captured the voices you just heard. At the 2017 Armory Art Fair, New York-based artist Patricia Cronin, with Eric Shiner, Vice President of Contemporary Art at Sotheby's, are talking to a small group of collectors gathered inside Patricia Cronin's Tack Room. This is one of the 12 large-scale projects that Eric Shiner curated for the fair's new platform section. Picture the intensity of immersive multimedia room-sized installations by male artists such as Jason Rhodes or Paul McCarthy, but with a female perspective. This freestanding wood replica of an essential space within a horse barn is filled with real-life evidence of the artist's personal passion for horses. Her own horse paintings and small cast horse sculptures are embedded in the display of sexually suggestive leather saddles, bridles, whips, and suede chaps. Images of horse-crazy girls, pages from Playboy, and stud magazines Breed of the Month centerfolds.
Virtually everything is the same as the first time we installed it at White Columns. It was in the inaugural show of their new space on 13th Street. Paul Ha was then the director. He's now the director at the List Visual Arts Center at MIT. It's kind of a trip down memory lane. I had to replace a few lights. The unicorn mask is new.
All these years of your fascination, your paintings of horses, mm-hmm. your girls and horses, your relationship with other horsewomen artists, mm-hmm. Janet Biggs.
Janet Biggs, yes, exactly. There's a Janet Biggs still from one of her shows right over there. Also, I have the most successful woman artist of the 19th century, Rosa Bonheur's horse fair print. And I love it that it's a self-portrait. She's the only human being in the work that doesn't have facial hair.
That's how you can tell it's her in the center. Well, also, she put herself in the center. But I'm just so happy to restage this and have it be installed again. And it's interesting because at an art fair where galleries, you know, rent a certain amount of real estate, and it costs a fortune for them to participate in these things, it is such an honor to be able to present a large-scale installation in the curated section.
It's fun to revisit it, also to see how evergreen the issues are that you address in the work.
That's kind of shocking. I mean, I was very curious what it was going to look like in new architecture in 2017. God knows we couldn't have envisioned the political climate we have in the United States right now. There was no way anybody could have seen this coming. To have women's sexuality and agency and autonomy.
Images of power, mm-hmm. individuality, yeah. Risk-taking.
Yes, control, desire, all of it. I work in so many different mediums, sometimes confuses people. Like, I do everything from I write books, I make, you know, small paintings, small watercolors, larger paintings, installations, then these kind of major installations, all the way up to monumental marble and bronze.
And the fabulous project you did at the Sackler Center.
The Harriet Hosmer catalog resume.
Yes.
Did I ever think I was going to write a catalog resume? Of course not. But I couldn't stand the dearth of scholarship on women artists. The first professional woman sculptor, Harriet Hosmer, didn't have a catalog resume. And I thought, well, this is untenable. I thought, you know what? If a legitimate art publisher isn't going to hire a real PhD art historian and pay them a salary for 5 to 10 years, which is what normally happens with a catalog resume, as an artist, I would do it for her. It took 5 years, and I wanted to make it legible that an artist was doing this. I decided to make a monochromatic watercolor of each and every one of her neoclassical marbles.
Little known and scarcely mentioned chapters in women's history have always attracted Patricia Cronin's attention. I remember the deeply moving experience of a project she created in Venice, Italy.
It was called Shrine for Girls. It was a solo collateral event, part of the Venice Biennale. Boko Haram kidnapping the Nigerian Chibok students, these gang rapes and lynchings in India, and the Magdalen laundries, forced labor camps for precocious girls in the UK and in Ireland, were driving me crazy. And these three stories all came to me or happened right around the same time when the Italian curator Ludovico Pertesi invited me to do a project in Venice. And so we knew the venue we wanted. It's the smallest church in Venice, Chiesa di San Gallo. It's right off of San Marco. It's a little jewel box. And I went there thinking I was going to be bringing big bronze sculptures. But when I got there and I looked around and I spent a few days really, you know, seeing what the space said to me and what I felt, I thought, no, it has to be about the girls. I've got three altars. I can't hang anything on the wall. I've got three stories of three distinctly separate groups of young women and girls, and they all come from different regions in the world, and they wear different clothes. I consider them gender martyrs. I'm going to treat their clothing, or clothing that they would wear, as their relics. I took their clothes and placed them on the altars, right above where previously religious relics had been. And then I put, just to the side of each pile of the hijabs, the saris, and the aprons, a small frame photograph of each of the different events. People had goosebumps. Everyone sobbed. From billionaire Russian collectors, the art cognoscenti, tourists, and even schools in Italy brought their school groups, boys and girls. They had lesson plans. They went from altar to altar talking about, I mean, it was incredible. And that's how I define success. That art can communicate across geographical boundaries and language barriers, and not how much something trades for at auction. I try to make art history. This is the goal. The goal is to really make a difference.
This is Fresh Art International. I'm Kathy Bird. You've been listening to a conversation with New York-based artist Patricia Cronin that took place inside her Tack Room installation at the 2017 Armory Art Fair.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1449.